Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are. This is Carl from ISF Podcast in Carl's Cavern. And we are finishing up our Black History Month series of podcasts. And with me tonight is author and music aficionado, and particularly New Orleans, Rick Coleman. Rick, nice to have you on the show.
Hi, Carl. Thank you. Good to be on the show. I'm kind of enjoying the thought of it because I just been thinking about it, and it's gotten to be a fun thing, I think. We'll have some fun tonight.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I have to at least mention this because I posted this on Like a Perversion, and that you and I met specifically on a podcast in honor of David Whittington, who was the founder of Incredibly Strange Films and someone I truly admired when he passed. And I just want to say that this podcast is dedicated to his memory, because I know David would love this music without a doubt.
David had a much wider taste in music than I ever had. But I like to think my taste is choice, but I'm much more of a old school rock and roll fan and obviously New Orleans fan, so I concentrate in those areas, and I'd like to consider myself a historian on those areas, and so that's what we're going to concentrate specifically, New Orleans and Fats Domino.
Well, you know, that's exactly one of the things is that you actually wrote a book. Biography of Fats Domino, and I know that you've got a upcoming book on the history of New Orleans, and so that's why this made perfect sense to me, because this is a music I have a great love of, and I wanted to tell you a quick story. Folks went, we used to go cross country. We lived in Pennsylvania, and we would take summer trips. My mother was a teacher. And we'd go places. We went down south. We went to New Orleans. I must have been around 8 years old. Wow. And I heard this wonderful music. And I kept saying I kept trying to go into the places, you know, on Bourbon Street where I heard this music. And I swear that the same black man followed me no matter where I went and told me I couldn't go in. Well, I raised such a bitch to my parents. Yeah. They decided to take me to Preservation Hall. Nice. I actually, at like 7 or 8 years old, I saw Ma Rainey, Frog Morton,
wow,
and a couple other people I can't remember. And we have this album where they signed it, and I still have that album in my record collection. Yeah.
Wow.
Seriously.
Ma Rainey. Wow.
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know she was.
I don't think she signed it, so she may not have been there. But I know Frog Morton did. But seriously, we had at least this is a story that I'm told throughout the family. So who knows if it's really true? But no question, I was at Preservation Hall, and I have a great love of New Orleans music. Seriously.
That's great.
This had to be 63 or 64. Had to be like 63 or 64.
I really have no clue about that time period. Well, I was slightly younger than you, but I would not really know exactly what was going on at that time, frankly, at Preservation Hall or whatever, but that sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was something that I remember the music more than anything else. And because of that, I've always had a great love. Now, so you did this book on Fats Domino, and I think we should focus on Fats and his music. So I know one of the songs that you had was The Fat Man. So why don't we start with that, and then after we come back, you can talk a little bit about Fats. We've got a couple other songs
like
that, too, coming.
All right, good.
So here it is, The Fat Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a major change from what was coming out of World War II, because basically big band music had been the music before World War II, but that since so many of the big band people went into the armies, all the big bands, or just about all of them, and that's when the ballad singers like Frank Sinatra took over. And so there was not too much dancing music after World War II. And that was a major change there. That you can't keep still listening to the Fat Man, you know what I'm saying?
No, you can't. And stylistically, that's a boogie, okay? And you're talking about a specific stylism in piano playing, which is called stride, if I'm correct. I think I am. But that has a lot to do with the New Orleans sound, the piano. And I just wanted to ask you why that is, or what your thoughts are on that.
Well, the New Orleans actually has some claim to boogie roots. Specifically, there was a piano player named Tony Jackson, who was a predecessor of Jelly Roll Morton, and also I'll have to think of the other guy's name, but he did a song called New Orleans Hop Scott Blues. He was technically from Houston, and he published that in New Orleans in 1916. And I'll think of his name in a minute. Hold on. But anyway, so that was that was a part of what was going on in New Orleans at the time, and that Fats was plugged into everything that was in New Orleans. But of course, the famous predecessor of the Fat Man was Champion Jack Dupree's Junkers Blues, and that Junkers Blues was basically a genre of the blues players in New Orleans. And Dave Bartholomew talks about it, that when he was growing up in the 20s and 30s, to all the players in New Orleans played that style, okay? All the old-time piano players. And the guy's name I was thinking about was George Thomas, and he was a friend of another piano player, Clarence Williams, and he came from Houston to New Orleans and published New Orleans Hopscotch Blues. And so he published similar things, but he brought his whole family from Houston. They were originally from Arkansas, but anyway, his sister Beulah later became famous because she changed her name to Sippy Wallace.
I know that name.
So they weren't originally from New Orleans, but they spent time in New Orleans, and then they moved, like most everybody in New Orleans, they moved to Chicago. So that was a forerunner of all that back in the teens. But like going back to Champion Jack Dupree, he did, he did this barrel house, junker house blues, and it was associated with drug heads that, because they were junkers.
Okay? Right, exactly.
So that meant they took drugs. But it's all the thing about people, junker blues, that people don't ever think about, it was really a clever pun. Because the original lyric was not, they call me the Fat Man. It was, they call me a junker. And the lyric was not, because I weigh 200 pounds. It was because they call me a junker because I'm loaded all the time. Now that is a pun, because there were also men that went around on wagons and collected junk. And Fats, when he was a child, actually contributed that, because he would pick scrap metal and stuff off the street wherever he went around in his neighborhood and give it to the junker man, okay, who had a wagon with a mule, and collect any kind of piece of crap that he thought he could sell for a few pennies or whatever. And so that's a joke there. They call me a junker because I'm loaded all the time, which take it at face value, it sounds like a drug deal, okay? He's loaded
right.
with junk. He's stoned, okay? But a junker
right, exactly.
was also a man who had, drove a junk wagon and loaded his wagon up with junk. So that's pretty ingenious, you know, for being a, you know, primitive blues. But anyway, Dave Bartholomew, when Lou Chudd came from Hollywood in November of 49, he met up with Lou Chudd, who was a Jewish guy originally from New York who moved to Los Angeles and started a record company. He had been recording since, you know, he was in New York, but he moved to Los Angeles and formed Imperial Records and originally recorded a lot of Mexican Latino music, but he branched out into rhythm and blues and he met Dave in Houston and told him he would come see him in New Orleans someday. And sure enough, he showed up on his doorstep in November of 49, literally knocked on his door. And so he says, I'm here and I'm looking for talent, you know. So Dave took him to see the talent that he knew. But the ironic thing was that Dave really didn't really think much of Fats Domino because he was just a teenage kid. And he used to show up at Dave's concerts in overalls. Okay. And after he was working all day, he was a mechanic and also he did other jobs. He worked in a mattress factory. So he would show up at Dave's gigs and Earl Palmer, who was the great drummer for Dave Bartholomew, who entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one night said, oh, I know that kid. He's a piano player. So we'll take a break. I'm going to ask him if he wants to sit in. So he did that without telling Dave. And so he had him sit in and he would do like a boogie woogie. Usually he did Swanee River Boogie, which is one of his great instrumentals. And supposedly Dave came up to Earl, as Earl told me this, that don't let that kid sit in. Because, again, Dave's band was high, you know, semi-high class, you know. They wore, you know, dress suits and everything, and Fats was in overalls, okay? So it wasn't, from my understanding, it really wasn't Dave's idea to take him to see Fats. There was actually a DJ in town who was huge, a guy named Papa Stoppa, and his real name was Henry Duke Thiel. And he apparently, he got tight with Lou Chudd almost immediately. You know, they were two white guys, but Henry Duke Thiel talked like a black guy on the radio, and he was extremely, extremely popular from 1948 on. He was really the forerunner, if not the forerunner of Alan Freed. And he's very little known now because he got sick and died young, but from 48 to 52, he was monstrous in the city of New Orleans. And it was that's just when Alan Freed rose up, right after he got sick. And anyway, he suggested to Lou Chudd that they go see Fats Domino at the Heidi Bowie Club, which is a very hole-in-the-wall shack near the tracks in the upper Ninth Ward, Club Desire, which is where Dave played. And so they all three of them went down together, and they saw Fats, and Lou Chudd loved him because Lou Chudd loved boogie woogie since the 30s in New Orleans, in New York. And he just, you know, fell in love with that, like you say, the boogie woogie sound. And he told Dave, you need to record this guy and, you know, let's make something, you know. And so Dave couldn't figure out what to do. He said, well, let's change that Junkers blues into different, you know, more user-friendly lyric. And so that's what they did, since he figured out they called him Fatso or Fat Man or, you know, the Fat Man. And so they said, they just change it to the Fat Man. And so that's what
exactly.
they did.
Okay, so
and
what we're going to do now. Oh, go ahead.
Ironically, Fats claimed he never heard Champion Jack Dupree's version, and he actually learned his version from his brother-in-law, Harrison Brett, who knew it from a pianist named Kid Stormy Weather.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay,
it became
so
a huge hit. It was number two and many people consider that the first rock and roll record.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, there's arguments on that. You could talk about the Jackie Brunson, Ike Turner cut or whatever, but certainly there's, you know, Fats Domino to me is one of the seminal first rock and rollers. So we're going to go on to Hela Boss Boogie.
Yeah, you brought it up. I got to rip on that. It's ironic you brought that up, because if you listen to Rocket 88, it actually has a very similar piano intro. But it also has a very similar beat. So there actually may be a little connection there. And Fat Man was late 49. Rocket 88 was 51.
Right, exactly. And you know, just so you know this about me, I'm a record collector. And so where I got to know a lot of this music was through record collection and not knowing until I listened to the music, and then would do a lot of research and that on the people. So what I want to keep us going with the music, and I'm just going by your playlist right now. We're going to do Hela Boss Boogie by Fats Domino. Here we go. It's that 1-4-5. The 1-4-5.
Oh, okay.
That is the structure of early rock and roll. And
yes, indeed.
You can't miss it in that.
Yes, indeed. That is such a wild rocker that people don't associate Fats with that kind of a wildness and just raucous sound.
Fats Domino, you think of Blueberry Hill, you think of I'm Walking, but you don't really think about it in those terms. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and there's a lot of backstory to that song. I'm going to edit it down as short as possible, but it was a connection with Fat's brother-in-law, Harrison Brett, who was a guitarist and banjo player with Papa Celestine, another traditional jazz bands. And Papa Celestine played that song, and that several of the traditional bands in the 40s played that in a much, much milder fashion. I mean, this is just rocking it like crazy. I don't know what the hell they thought of that, but they thought he was crazy or something. But the thing is that there's also postulated a even deeper, darker roots to that song, in that some people have written that it's actually, they think the roots of that may actually go back to Africa, because there was a famous god, or minor god, I don't know, not major god, but a god of the crossroads, actually, it's Robert Johnson fame, was a guy named Legba, and yeah, that was shortened to Laba, supposedly. Now, it also means hey over there in French, so maybe some conflation there, but the thing is that, you could kind of see the African roots when Fats does it, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
But also, yeah, you also have to give credit to Herbert Hardesty, who was Fats' lead saxophone player for nearly 60 years, if you can imagine. He started with him in 49 at the Fat Man session, and which ironically Herbert Hardesty thought was when Dave told him we were going to record the Fat Man, Herbert Hardesty thought of the radio character at the time, the Fat Man, who was Dashiell Hammett's twin to the Thin Man.
Right, exactly.
It kind of boggles your mind. And so he actually thought he was going to be recording the radio character, the when he went to the studio. But anyway, when he did Hey La Ba, that's Herbert Hardesty blowing those raucous solo, extended solo, and he was not known for that. He did very melodic solos on most of Fats' records, but the great saxophone player who's known for the raucous solos was Lee Allen. Okay. Mm-hmm. Who was a big 6'4" blowing son of a gun, originally from Kansas, but he lived in New Orleans since college, okay? And he blew incredibly raucous solos, notably on all of Little Richard's records. If you hear Little Richard's hits, every one of the raucous solos on the big hits, except for Keep a Knockin', is Lee Allen. So he should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame too. But anyway, Herbert Hardesty was blowing it that similar to Lee Allen on that. And so that was an amazing, fiery way they started. And it was never a hit, but it just an amazing record.
So where do you want to go now? On your playlist, we go to Dave Bartholomew, but we can continue with Fats Domino,
well,
if you wish.
Yeah, let's do Dave. Let's bury it up a little bit. The similarly raucous Good Jack's Boogie, if you got that handy.
Okay. And I have a question about this afterwards, okay?
Okay.
So we're going to go to Good
Jack's backstory on all of these. So.
Absolutely. Okay, so here we go. Good Jack's Boogie.
Oh, hold on one second. If you hear...
Okay, hold on. Okay, held that.
I told you about Papa Stoppa. There's a
right
story behind Papa Stoppa, and there was a guy in New Orleans who was an art instructor at Dillard University in 1940s, and he was originally from Ohio, but anyway, he was a very light-skinned guy, and he went down and wanted to have black people heard on the radio, because there was no black radio in New Orleans whatsoever at the time, and he proposed to a local station called WJMR that they have a black show. Actually proposed to several stations, but they were the only ones that replied to him. And so he went down there and talked to him about it, doing it. And they said, well, that sounds like a good idea. We can make some money. Now, they didn't actually realize immediately that he was black. And right. when he started talking jive talk, they suddenly realized he was black, and they said, "Oh, are you?" You know, they did. They said, "Are you black?" Except they didn't use that word; they used an impolite word.
Right,
and
exactly.
He said, and he, you know, he admitted that he was. You know, but the thing is that, oh no, we can't use you on the radio. However, we'll let you produce the show, and so that's how Papa Stoppa came to being. Is that he taught white announcers to talk black, and he wrote the jive talk. He gave them the records, and he named the show Papa Stoppa, and he was the producer. Okay, and that's how I think, not 100% sure of this, but that's how Roy Brown's Good Rockin' at Night became a hit in 1947, because he was the producer on the show, and he saw how popular Roy Brown was. Anyway, so he got fired for actually announcing a station break, you know, saying this is WJMR, when the DJ was in the bathroom. And so he was fired, okay? And so he, you know, still had ambitions and wanted to become a black radio announcer. And he got inspired by Louis Jordan, who took a stand for integration at Municipal Auditorium in November of 48. And he had a song called Daddy-O, and so he wanted to be called Dr. Daddy-O. Okay. And so in May of 49, he became the first black DJ in New Orleans as Dr. Daddy-O, and his show was sponsored by Jack's Beer. And if you listen carefully, this was essentially a commercial for Jack's Beer, and there was actually commercials
exactly
in black theaters.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you.
Yep. There were actually commercials in black theaters with Dave Bartholomew, with Fats Domino, with Roy Brown, some others, and they were. And it's unfortunate that none of them survive, apparently, but they actually filmed those. And this is the only surviving example of it, except it's only on a recording. It's a great recording, and doesn't sound like a commercial at all. But if you listen carefully, it's plugging Jack's Beer, and you'll also, in the very climax of it, you'll hear supposedly Dr. Daddy was actually heard yelling. He kind of yells off key and very high, yeah, or something like that. And if you listen carefully, you might be able to hear him. So it's an amazing history behind this story, and again, it's part of the integration of American music, and specifically New Orleans music, and Dr. Daddy was behind that. He was a great pioneer, and Dave was this vehicle here.
Okay, so here
and
we go with Good Jack's Boogie.
Yes, indeed.
such a great tune. Good God.
Yeah, man, it's a rocking thing, and when you hear know the history behind it, it makes it so much more amazing.
Well, I was going to ask you. It sounded like a commercial, and I was going to get into that
after
the song.
Yeah, that's why I said that
before.
Full disclosure, I said that before it. But
I know.
Anyway,
I know. So you were ahead of me. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. Fats actually, apparently, he actually did his version of this song in the commercial that he filmed. And like I said, it would be awesome if anybody ever found that. But I should mention a couple things about that. First of all, is that I mentioned Lee Allen earlier, who played on a lot of Fats Domino records. He toured with Fats for 20 or 30 years. And along with Herbert Hardesty, and two sax legends of New Orleans, and they would alternate sometimes. But anyway, that's the great Lee Allen playing the solo on that. If you listen to it carefully, you'll hear him saying, "Ride, Lee, ride, ride, Lee, ride."
Nice.
So that is awesome sax. And sometimes, like I said, they had both of them in the band. So it was just an incredible thing. Like I said, there's a cat. He mentioned a cat named Daddy-O. And like I said, that was Dr. Daddy-O literally hearing, yelling on the record. And then also at the beginning, he plays that trumpet intro. Dave plays that. Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da.
Right.
Part of the Holler Blues. Okay, and it has many, many different names. There's at least a half a dozen names for that song, but that intro is usually a part of the Holler Blues, and it's also a famous call and response because he says da na da na, and they go yeah, da na da na, yeah, dun dun dun,
yeah, exactly.
Dun, 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 dun. Okay, so that comes in later on in our show here. That we'll talk about that again, but I actually think that Buddy Bolden, as the great jazz legend, who there was a movie made about him a couple of years. I don't know if anybody ever saw it, but he's the forgotten father of New Orleans jazz. He's kind of like Robert Johnson is to the blues, supposedly.
Right.
Buddy Bolden was to jazz. The thing is, he was just a legend locally amongst blacks, but the whites ignored it, okay, partly because mm-hmm. they were afraid of him, I really think, because he had such a great following in the black community, and they almost never mentioned him. The only time they mentioned him was when he got arrested. So anyway, that trumpet intro may have been similar to what Buddy Bolden played at the turn of the century when he wanted to call his children to come to his gigs. He would do that similar type of horn blast, and he would literally be heard for miles, and they would come to his shows.
Well, the interesting thing about Buddy Bolden, I do have to mention this, is that it was a white person's music that introduced me to Buddy Bolden, and that would be Dr. John, because he has this great song about Buddy Bolden, and I heard that and I said, well, who's Buddy Bolden? Then I did research on him and found out who Buddy Bolden was. So
well, that's the only way that you learn about Buddy Bolden, but
absolutely,
like I say, because the white Dr. John, I mean, I don't know how, he really totally immersed himself in black culture. So,
and the culture of New Orleans, which is primarily black. And let's not, forget that the music that came out of New Orleans was, you talk about Dixieland, you talk about jazz, you talk about any of those types of, Zydeco, maybe not so much.
We could literally go on for hours, so let's not get into that.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway.
Absolutely. And maybe we could do a couple shows like this if you feel comfortable after this.
Let's continue so we can try to get most of this playlist in.
Absolutely. We're going to continue with Monkey Speaks His Mind, and I wanted to mention something here before we listen to this. Signifying is basically a way of telling a story, generally with music or at the very, very least rhythm and pentameter, and it's basically a very much a predecessor of rap music in many ways. And it's very, very much part of the African-American experience. And I never knew until you picked this song, Dave Bartholomew did this. I had no idea that it went back this far into New Orleans culture. So we're going to listen to The Monkey Speaks His Mind. And after that, you can, after the song, you can comment and either agree or disagree with me. So here we go.
All right.
Monkey Speaks His Mind.
Yeah. The monkey speaks his mind. Now, three monkeys sat in a coconut tree, discussing things as they are said to be. Said one to the other, now listen, you two, there's a certain rumor that can't be true, that man descended from our noble race. The very idea is a big disgrace. No monkey ever deserted his wife, starved her baby, and ruined her life. Yeah. The monkey speaks his mind. And you never known a mother monk to leave the babies with others to bone, or pass them on from one to another till they basically knew who was their mother. Yeah. The monkey speaks his mind. And another thing you will never see, a monkey build a fence around a coconut tree and let other coconuts go to waste, forbidding all other monkeys to come and taste. Why, if I put a fence around this tree, salvation would force you to steal from me. Yeah, the monkey speaks his mind. Here's another thing a monkey won't do, go out at night and get on a stew. I use a gun, a club, or knife to take another monkey's life. Yes, man descended the worthless bum, but brothers, from us he did not come. Yeah, the monkey speaks his mind.
Yeah.
Wow.
it's a strange history behind that, which I haven't uncovered the whole history behind that, but Dave actually said that there was a guy that gave that song, or at least the lyric, to him after a concert one time. And the thing is that I traced it back in newspapers, and I traced it back at least to the 1930s and probably the 20s. The reason why is because I think that was actually an answer to the Scopes trial. So, Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan in Legendary, after the exact years at 26 or something.
27.
Fought over evolution being taught in the schools. And so that makes total sense to why that lyric would have come up. However, it sounds, it sounds like a ancient African Caribbean thing, but I'm not sure that it is. It's just a very clever story. But obviously, as you say, that is, there's so many signifying songs. I mean, Chuck Berry did a couple of them. What, JoJo Gunn or something? Was that what? Was
yeah, JoJo Gunn is one.
Do you know some others? But anyway.
Well, I can tell you where I
there's,
I
there's
really,
so many monkey lion
so
things
many songs.
That.
Go ahead.
But I'm not sure how far it goes back, but definitely the Scopes trial, I think, is a significant thing that it may have been related to. But I think Dave may have just made up the music to it, but it's such an incredible groove there, you know. And so, it's been covered by people. I actually saw a version of Dave doing this with Elvis Costello doing the verses and Dave just doing the Monkey Speaks His Mind part and with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. And so that was pretty
nice.
Amazing. Yeah.
Nice.
So anyway, great record.
Oh, absolutely. Where I went signifying was Rudy Ray Moore and Dolomite.
Uh-huh.
And I really learned about it there and then went back and saw some of the songs, including the JoJo Gunn. But I didn't know that Dave had done one. So this is a complete surprise to me. And thank you for putting the song on, really.
Yeah, there's actually an interesting connection with Rudy Ray Moore. He actually used to tour with Huey Piano Smith and the Clowns back in the late 50s.
You just picked out the person that I have maybe for the end of the show. I love
you. Want to hold that story? You want to hold that story?
No, that's okay. You can tell the story. Tell the story.
Well, I mean, they toured together in a station wagon, and his catchphrase that he kept using over and over was, "Don't you just know it?"
Mm-hmm.
And Huey heard that. And he repetition of it, and he said, "That's a good name for a song." And that became Huey Smith and the Clowns' biggest hit, Know It.
And that's the song that I picked for that exact reason.
Okay, we told that story, but we'll figure something else to tell you about it later on. But anyway, what are we doing next?
Okay, so I think the next one, we're back to Fats. And Mardi Gras in New Orleans. So we want to do that one?
Yeah, I got to mention that we skipped over this, but the thing is, we originally wanted to do this show on Saturday, which actually was Fats' birthday. Would have been his 94th birthday. Of course, he died in 2017, but Fats would have been 94 on Saturday, and so that's why we wanted to focus on Fats, not necessarily because I wrote a book about it called Blue Monday. I just want to put in some little background behind that because I've been writing on New Orleans music for over 40 years. This is actually the 40th anniversary of my first article being published, which ironically was on Bo Diddley. I just happened to, totally naive kid, I was lucked into an interview with Bo Diddley in 1982, and I did a radio show on him, and I wrote it up as a story for Wavelength Magazine, New Orleans, and it became my first published story. And so I was very proud of that and had a great interview with Bo Diddley, man. Ironically, one of the things he told me is his mother was from New Orleans. And the only reason he was born in Mississippi is because his mother was unmarried and pregnant and had to go where her family was. And so she was born in Mississippi, but she was a New Orleans lady. So he has New Orleans roots too, so that's pretty heavy. And anyway, 37 years ago, I met Fats Domino for the first time, 1985, and Dave Bartholomew did me the great honor of taking him to his backstage trailer, which he was playing a seafood festival on the north shore of New Orleans of Lake Pontchartrain here. And I was very shy, and Fats just cottoned to me immediately, and we had a great stay together, and we were friends, and I went to his house, and I got to some great interviews, and that was got the ball rolling, and so I had to write a book, and it took me 20 years to write a book on Fats Domino, and which is pretty crazy, but it's true, and I finally got it out in 2006. It's called Blue Monday, Fats Domino, and the Lost Dawn of Rock and Roll. and I won a huge award for it. I won the ASCAP Award for Best Music Biography, and I actually received my award at Lincoln Center in New York City, the only time I've ever been to New York City. And the guy that won the award right after me was Les Paul, who was like 93 years old, and I got to meet him. And so that was a pretty amazing night, and I'm very, very proud of all that. But anyway, I also co-produced a documentary on Fats Domino called Fats Domino, The Big Beat and the Birth of Rock and Roll, something like that. And it was actually part of the American Masters PBS series, which broadcast while Fats was still living in 2016 on his birthday. So it was so exactly 6 years ago that it was first broadcast. And I'm very, very proud of that because we interviewed all of the surviving originators of Fats Band, Dave Bartholomew, Cosmo Matassa, I actually did interview Lou Chud in my book, but not on camera. But anyway, Herbert Hardesty, his other band members. And so that's an amazing, amazing accomplishment. Joe Lauro was the producer of that and director of that documentary. I'm very, very proud of that. And you know they don't show it on PBS anymore, but you can actually buy the DVD, and I highly recommend that you do. And it has some extras and a great concert footage from 1962, just amazing concert footage. And you can see some of that on YouTube, but I highly recommend that you get the documentary. I don't make any money off of it, so I'm not cashing in, but it's really something I'm very proud of. Fats Domino, Big Beat, and The Birth of Rock and Roll. So that's a DVD to buy. But also coincidentally, today is Lundi Gras. Anybody know what Lundi Gras is? It's the day before.
I should know. By the way, we've got TC with us now, too. TC's with us.
Hey,
I'm
back.
Lundi Gras is, TC?
Yes, I do.
Okay, talk to me.
Let the expert explain it, tell you all about it. I know it. But I know the name.
Yeah. They've just celebrated Lundi Gras for about 30 years now, but the thing is, it's not a big deal, but it's the day before Mardi Gras, and tomorrow, that means tomorrow is Mardi Gras. And so it's a huge festive time in New Orleans. A million people, you know, come see Mardi Gras over the course of 2 weeks, but mostly tomorrow. And so this is Fats' Mardi Gras record, which he copied from Professor Long here. So you want to go ahead and play it, or you want to?
I got it right here. Here we go. Mardi Gras in New Orleans by Fats Domino. Come on,
Carl.
It's playing.
You got it from Professor Long here.
You know what? It doesn't look like it. There it is.
Down on there, right there, until I see the Zulu Queen.
If you're not a care dancer to that, something's wrong. Seriously.
That's great.
Yeah, let's see.
Hey, Rick,
talk a minute.
Rick, yeah. I have to tell you something, man. I almost ran a red light because of you. I told you I was on the But when you mentioned Lee Allen, I almost jumped out of my seat, man. That guy and I wholeheartedly agree. He should have a whole damn wing in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Walking with Mr. Lee is one of my favorite instrumentals of all time. So,
yeah,
I gotcha. And, you know, I wish there's a recording out there. After he left New Orleans, you know, he thought that the scene was starting to die. So he went to Southern California in the mid-60s. He hooked up with T-Bone Walker and Big Joe Turner, and I wish there were recordings of that around. Can you imagine?
Oh. Yeah, and he toured with the Blasters for several years.
Yeah.
And but in between touring with Fats now, because he was
the
mainstay of Fats band.
He toured with Fats right up into the 90s, didn't he? I mean, right up until almost before he
died.
Off and on, like, you know.
It was early 90s, I think, is when he last played with that. But he was a hell of a player, man.
He was on the second Stray Cats album, playing with my guitar hero, Brian Setzer. So I got to go revisit that. So, okay.
Yeah.
That was my 2 cents.
So, the background on this record we just heard was that that was the second tour that Fats ever did, and the Fats didn't want a tour. He was extremely shy and a homeboy, as they say, homebody, and he didn't want to go out of the city of New Orleans. He actually hid when the time came for to go on the tour, and they had to track him down to get him to go in Dave Bartholomew. He had 2 station wagons. The first tour was out to the West Coast in the spring of 50, and they were touring on the Fat Man, and there are a lot of stories in that, but you can have to read my book on that. But the second tour was from Texas up to Kansas City. And they were playing in, around Kansas City, whatever, wherever it was. And they had a big snowstorm, and they actually had to hibernate in the club for a while. And the guy said he didn't have any money, so they were eating all the guy's food at the club since he wasn't paying them. But the Fats decided to take a bus home at that point, and Dave Bartholomew and his band stayed and went and checked out the streets of Kansas City and all the great bands there. But the thing was that they actually had kind of an all-star lineup. The first tour had Herbert Hardesty, and Tommy Ridgely was Dave's other singer besides Fats, because at one point Dave used Tommy Ridgely as his blues singer, his Roy Brown type of shouter, and he also sang ballads. And then he used Fats, but Fats was never really kind of an official member of Fats, Dave's band. But anyway, he did tour with him, like I said, and played gigs with him. But anyway, on the second tour, he had Fats, obviously, and also Lee Allen instead of Herbert Hardesty, and then also they had Professor Longhair. And Professor Longhair had just scheduled I just scored his one and only chart hit, which was a song called Bald Head. And it's one of the legendary songs in his canon, which goes, look there, she ain't got no hair, bald head. He ain't got no hair. So anyway, we're not going to play that tonight. But the thing is that so that was his classic hit that he actually scored on Mercury Records. But he had also recorded at that time Mardi Gras in New Orleans, which is also called Go to the Mardi Gras, and is kind of semi-legendary in New Orleans musical circles, especially because it's played every Mardi Gras, obviously, but the people play it other times of the year, too, because it's such a great record. And he recorded it many, many times, but at least three times in the studio. And actually, one time, he recorded in East St. Louis, believe it or not, as East St. Louis Baby. And I go to East St. Louis, I'm going to – anyway, it's the same tune. Look it up on YouTube if you can. But anyway, so touring with Professor Longhair, Pat learned a lot from Professor Longhair because Longhair had been playing as a semi-professional musician since the 30s, a long time before Pat. And so he learned all that complicated Caribbean syncopation and whatever from Longhair. And so he learned how to play Mardi Gras in New Orleans from Longhair. And so he decided when he was with Dave then, but they had a breakup for over a year. And when he got back together with Dave, he decided to record Mardi Gras in New Orleans, his own version. And he did a great version. And it actually put it on the back B side of a big hit he had called Going to the River, I believe. And which is a slow ballad about drowning yourself in the river in Mississippi. But anyway, it was a happy side of that record. And so anyway, that was how Fats came to record it, and Fats performed it for many, many years, probably, you know, most all of his career. And, that's again, another great reason to see, that, Fats Domino, the Big Beat documentary, because he does it live in 1962 with this great band, Herbert Hardesty, Lee Allen, Dave Bartholomew, all of his great, many of his original band members, a great version of this in France. And he does Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and he, you know, he rocks the place. He sometimes did long versions of it, 4 or 5 minutes. So anyway, that's the story of that.
Go ahead, TC.
You know, you mentioned how shy Fats Domino was, you know, and I can see it in some of his performances. He's always kind of looking up. But also, he is one of the few piano players, singers you see, where he has a microphone on the side, where he's actually facing the crowd. Now, you think if he was shy, you know, he'd have the microphone in front where he's playing the piano and looking forward like most people do. I just always thought that was an interesting style he had for live performance, especially for a shy guy.
Okay. I just realized we've only gotten through 5 songs, and we got to get rolling.
You
got
That's why I'm saying. Let's go on.
Okay,
to the next
okay.
One.
Let's stop talking.
We got a lot of music
one.
To go.
Go to the next one.
Keep it
okay,
moving.
So now we're going to go to someone who we all love, and I know you've played a couple songs of Louis. So have I over the years, and this is Louis Armstrong. My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. And Rick, you can tell us a little bit about it after the song.
Okay.
Thank you. but kids got a hole in it. The bucket's got a hole in it. The bucket's got a hole in it. And we can't buy no more beer. I said the bucket's got a hole in it. Too bad the bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, man, the bucket's got a hole in it. Somebody better run your aspect.
It's after hours and you can't get in.
I know how it is, Jack.
It's after hours and you can't get in.
You're up there.
We closed at 9 and now it's 10:30. Oh, honey, won't you be all again?
Blow it, Jack. Blow it, Daddy. Blow it.
Yeah, that's a slow version of it. Louis also did kind of semi-up-tempo versions of it, which I actually had chosen one of those. But that's a great version. And the thing is that people have no clue about the roots of that. Okay, for one thing, they have no clue what the song is about. But the thing is that song, the reason why it's a strange song is because it's nothing that we can relate to today, because it actually dates to the turn of the century, 1900, not 2000. And the thing is, in those days, you went to a bar and you didn't order a glass of beer or a bottle of beer. You brought your own bucket. And so therefore, they would fill up your beer, and it'd be kind of like having a keg or something. And the people would just drink out of the bucket with a dipper or whatever. And having a hole in your bucket was therefore a big problem, because you couldn't buy no beer, as he says. So it's very strange. We can't relate to it, but that's where it goes back to. It's so old that that's the story. But the thing, and actually, apparently the first version of this was by Buddy Bolden, okay? And I have actually dated this back to 1904. There's a mention of it in the Picayune, of all places, the society pages of the Times Picayune. It was the Daily Picayune then. And they're talking about automobile enthusiasts, who were in 1904 were well-to-do guys, having a party on the lake. And they actually said they had a fish stew, which in French they call a courbillon, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And they had a party. They said they had a swimming contest. And one of the guys sang "Any Rags," which was the song about a junk man collecting rags. And also somebody sang "Bucket Got a Hole in It." And that, as I said, goes back to Buddy Bolden, okay? That's the first person ever known to do this song. And it actually relates to Louis Armstrong because he never knew for sure if he actually ever saw Buddy Bolden because he left New Orleans in 1907, okay, when Louis was 6 years old. But he lived in the area where Buddy Bolden played, and this is an actual quote that Louis gave in the 60s here. It says, when I was about 4 or 5, still wearing dresses, little boys wore dresses in those days, and that's another thing that's totally forgotten these days, I lived with my mother in Jane's Alley, and right in the middle of that in Perdido Street was the Funky Butt Hall where Buddy Bolden played. Old beat up, big cracks in the wall, and Saturday nights, Mama couldn't find us because we wanted to hear that music before the dance band would play. Before the show, they would play out in front for a half hour to advertise the show. And he says, and us little kids would all do little dances. If I ever heard Buddy Bolden play the cornet, I figure that's when. So he actually was also stayed around, you know, without probably his mother knowing and looking into the club, you know, through the cracks and seeing the people doing crazy things. He said that there were women, you know, acting real salacious there and stuff. And he says it's possible that he actually saw Buddy Bolden before he left town, like I said, 1907, by just looking in the Funky Butt Hall. And that was the song that he singled out that he heard. So it's very possible that was, he heard that directly from Buddy Bolden. And so that's probably the same kind of tempo that Buddy Bolden would have given it. But, of course, later on, the people speeded it up. And the bizarre side story to that is that the song went around the country in many ways. And one of the Hank Williams was taught this song by a black man named T-Tot in Alabama. And the song Buckets Got a Hole In was never copyrighted. So Clarence Williams, who was a very smart businessman and pianist from New Orleans, he copyrighted the song in the 30s, I think 33, right when Prohibition ended. He copyrighted it because it was a drinking song, okay? And so if you ever look on the sheet music, it says Clarence Williams, or it usually even says C. Williams. Now, when Hank Williams said he wanted to record that, it had said C. Williams. So many people just assumed that was Hank Williams wrote it, but no. It was a piano player from New Orleans, and he's reciting what happened in the Funky Butt Hall in 1900. So talk about mind-blowing stories.
I was going to mention that I actually had seen the sheet music to that. My folks used to collect old sheet music. And I remember seeing the sheet music to that dating from like the 1930s. So I was going to ask about that. Very cool. Very cool. I did not know that.
Yes, and there's also Ricky
on
Nelson had
at this point. Okay,
Ricky Nelson had a hit
up,
with
Rick.
It.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Ricky Nelson had a hit with it, and has sheet music with Ricky Nelson's picture on it too. So, go to the next song.
Right. Okay, so I happen to know the story of Marie Laveau. So does TC, but we know the Bobby Bear version. Or, you know, Dr. Hook also did a version of the Bobby Bear. But this is Papa Celestin. And
Papa Celestin.
This is Celestin, okay? I was thinking Celeste, okay? I'm a musician. Give me a break.
Yeah.
So, anyway, this is, would you say that again? Papa?
Celestin. Or Celestin.
Celestin, okay. Celestine, like Philistine, but Celestine. Okay, Celery and Steen. Okay, gotcha. Here we go. Marie Laveau by Papa Celestine. Come on. Here we go.
Thank you. UFO. Believe it or not, strange as it seems, she made a fortune selling voodoo and interpreting dreams. She was known throughout the nation as the Voodoo Queen. Folks come to her from miles and miles around. She'd show them how to put that voodoo down. To the voodoo lady, they would go, rich, educated, ignorant and poor. She'd snap her fingers and shake her head, then tell them about their lovers, living or dead. An old lady named Widow Brown, she asked why her lover stopped coming around. The voodoo gazed at her and squalled, I seen him kissing a young girl way up in Shakespeare's park. And then there are no free lost her speech. Tears start rolling down her cheeks. She says, hush, my darling, don't you cry. I'll make him come back by and by. Now sprinkle the snake dust all over your clothes. He'll come back Friday morning when the rooster crows. Oh, Marina Bo.
Hey, Marina
Bo.
Hey, Marina Bo.
Oh, Marina Bo. Voodoo queen, way down yonder in New Orleans. Now, Marina Bo, help them in her hand. New Orleans was her promised land. Quality folks come from far and near. This wonder woman, far to hear. They were afraid to be seen at her gate and would creep through the dark to hear their fate. Pulling down veils over their head, they would tremble to hear what Marina would say. Oh, Marina Bo. Made Gree Gree with an old ram horn stuffed with feathers and shucked from a comb, a big black cattle and a cat defense made a man get religion and give up his sin. Oh, Marina Bo. On voodoo in New Orleans. Sad news got up one morning at the dawn of day. Marie Laveau had passed away in St. Louis Cemetery. She lays in a tomb. She was buried at night on the wake of the moon.
Marie Laveau.
So I'm just going to go to TC for his reaction on that, because you had never heard that before, I think.
No, I listened to a little bit last night when we were talking about it. That song's just incredible. I mean, one of my biggest problems is, you know, I think of what it reminds me of, but right away the New Orleans dirge sound comes out so heavy in that, you know, where, you know what I mean by the dirge that New Orleans is famous for. And also it seems, you know, I mean, I kept thinking of Minnie the Moocher, you know, I mean, along that type of lines, but a female version of Minnie the Moocher almost. But what a classic song that was, and thanks for sharing that. That's a new one in my life that I didn't have before.
So tell us a little bit about Papa Celestine, Rick.
Papa Celestine dated back to the Tuxedo Jazz Band in the teens, and through the, well, he went through the early 50s, and he was not considered really a great horn player. He's a trumpet player, but he was a great, great entertainer. And he supposedly didn't even sing, didn't know he could sing until around 1918 or so. And then he started singing. He sang, at that time, he sang Little Eyes of Jane was his featured song. And he was a very popular figure. He actually played white baseball games, the minor league team, the Pelicans. He led the band in the grandstand and anything. But anyway, he went he had a falling out in the depression like everybody else, and he had trouble getting gigs. And then he, you know, didn't really gig really until, you know, through World War II, he had very few gigs. But the thing is, he got into an automobile accident just as the war was ending. And he was, you know, he walked with a limp thereafter, but he made a great comeback in 1946. And he put his band back together. And one thing about Papa is that he was a great source member of a lot of great musicians. Dave Bartholomew, especially, played with him not for very long, probably, you know, 6 months or less. But he was highly, highly influenced. Matter of fact, you can listen, and the way that Dave phrases "the monkey speaks his mind" is actually very similar to what Papa did in Marie Laveau there. And also that Dave hired a bunch of Papa's musicians, a bunch of Dave's sax players, his early sax players in the late 40s and early 50s, were from Papa Celestine musicians. And then on the other hand, you had Dave, Pat Domino's brother-in-law playing for Papa Celestine. So they were both, he was kind of in some ways a transitional figure, and he had a very significant moment at the end of his life, because of two huge events that happened. One is that he was called for a presidential command performance, basically, in Washington, D.C. with his band, and played for all of the, you know, Congress and the president and the Supreme Court and everybody in 1954. And this was, you know, a landmark thing, you know, that, you know, it wasn't even that big. He never had a national hit, but he played for the president. And Eisenhower complimented him highly and said he could listen to another hour of his music. I'm sure he didn't hear more than a half hour there. But anyway, so that was heavy. And then on top of that, he was in a big movie called Cinerama Holiday, which was significant. And it was like one of the very first movies that had like three screens, totally immersing the viewer in the big, big theaters, and he performed Tiger Rag in there, and it's quite an amazing performance, which I think you can see on YouTube, which he starts mewing, and he starts roaring, and then he starts pawing, and it's quite an impressive performance. And also the Young Tuxedo Band, which was his offshoot, since he couldn't march anymore because he was crippled, they had the Young Tuxedo Band, which did a second line, and that's one of the very first second lines that people saw all over the world. People, and that we're going to get into that a little bit. As you said, this is very similar to the New Orleans style of dirge at a funeral, the way he sang it at the beginning. And so they played the first, people not from New Orleans don't know about New Orleans funerals. You know, that's what they call a jazz funeral. And if you're an aficionado of the music, you know about it. But most people around the world do not know what this is. And basically, it has African roots that they celebrated at funerals. And people from Anglo-Saxon countries think that's crazy. You don't do that. You got to be always, you know, very dirge-like and very sad. But they did that. But then they would do that on the way to the burial. But on the way back, they would play happy music. And that's where New Orleans jazz is rooted in that. In the celebration coming back from a funeral, that's where most of the roots of New Orleans music is in. And but this sounded like a dirge, and we'll get to the happy part. But I also have to mention Marie Laveau. There's so many songs about Marie Laveau. Witch Queen of New Orleans is another one. Tammy Lynn did one. I'm trying to think what the name of that was, which was also recorded by Larry Williams and the Neville Brothers, and I can't think of it. But anyway, numerous songs. There's probably dozens of songs about Marie Laveau. She even had one that she sang, her followers sang when she was alive. And she was just an amazing figure and matrilineal leadership as, African was, rooted around her in New Orleans, that she led what they call the St. John's Eve celebrations every June 23rd. That was their big holiday, and they would go someplace by the lake, and it was very secretive and furtive where they would celebrate, and they had these strange celebrations, and that they actually became quite fashionable in the 1870s and 1880s to try to, for white folks and everybody else, to try to find where Marie Laveau and her followers were celebrating, because they knew that was going to be a great party. And I actually see that as a forerunner of New Orleans Jazz Festival, because it is a cross-cultural celebration of music. Now, there's a lot of religion in it, too, but it became much more secular right when Marie was getting elderly. Celebration that she had anything to do with, she actually had her secretary write a letter to the Times-Picayune to advertise it. So you can see that it was becoming a festival. And so it was an amazing thing. And shortly thereafter, they basically put the kowtow to that. They didn't have any more, popular festivals of, on St. John's Eve for voodoo. But that was quite something when that was happening in the late 1800s. So
some people knew how to party.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So this way we can move on. Okay. And what we're going to do is go to another seminal musician that has been mentioned today, but actually we're going to listen to Jelly Roll Morton. Didn't he ramble? And then, Rick, I'm going to have you talk about Jelly Roll afterwards, okay?
Yeah, and keep in mind, this is the format of a New Orleans funeral. He does the dirge at the beginning of this song, and which is like the hymn that they would do. I think I'm trying to think of the name of it, but he does a religious song at the beginning, and then they break into Didn't He Ramble, which is a secular celebration, which is what they would have done on after the burial, coming back from the funeral.
Okay, so we've got funeral music here by Jelly Roll Morton. Didn't he ramble? Come on. I don't know. Sometimes...
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. If the women don't get you, the liquor must.
Tell us a little bit about Jelly Roll Morton, Rick.
Yeah, that's some history. That again goes back to the turn of the century, and but actually centuries before that, because that originally was an old minstrel. I'm talking about English minstrel song called Darby Ram or Derby Ram, but that's how we pronounce it. But in England, they probably pronounce it Darby, and it was about a giant sheep. And how they would shear a giant sheep. They said that the sheep was so big that he was 10 yards high, and each hoof covered an acre. So it was a joking song about a giant sheep. But the thing is, what happened is that it had a great chorus, and the chorus said, "Didn't he ramble? He rambled. He rambled out of town, all around the round. He rambled till the butcher cut him down." Okay, so that was talking about the people that would butcher the sheep. But that was a great chorus. And what happened is that there were three black men. They were not from New Orleans, but they took the song and they gave it a modern story about a rambling son, kind of like a black sheep, if you will. And one of these three guys was James Weldon Johnson, who actually wrote the a black national anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, in 1899. And but he said that it is from the blues that all that may be called American music derives its most distinctive characteristic. So that was mighty lofty. You know, Lift Every Voice and Sing is obviously very lofty. But the thing is that they took the song, and it Didn't He Ramble was its huge hit in New Orleans. And it became one of the biggest funeral songs, along with When the Saints Go Marching In. And but actually before that, it was a football song. They used it at football games, oddly. But it became a huge, huge anthem in New Orleans. And the whole last 10, 15 pages of my book are talking about Didn't He Ramble and all the different ramifications of that movie, with that song. There's actually several movies that use it as in showing New Orleans funerals. So it's quite an amazing story. And Louis Armstrong talked about how King Oliver, his best friend and surrogate father, would play that, and it would stir up people that they would leave wherever they were and follow King Oliver. And there's so many great stories about that. But like I said, so much of New Orleans jazz is rooted in that funeral celebration, and it is playing this, call and response tune that with the great musicians play them off of each other and soloing. So
yeah,
we probably
song.
Need to go on
Gene,
up to
what
whatever
do you think
that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Kelly Roll Morton. I mean, it was great. And I love the history of that song. I have actually heard that before, but, I didn't dig back far enough to see where it came from. And I love how it starts out as a funeral. And then seems like it's a whole New Orleans thing where the funerals get happy down there. And that song got a little happiness to it.
Yeah, if you ever see, there's two movies which it introduces two movies. If you have a chance to see these movies, check them out. Just the first, you got to watch the first 3 or 4 minutes of the movie. It's that song is, and a New Orleans funeral march is in both of these. One, the first one is Pete Kelly's Blues, and that is a full scene in color, with Teddy Buckner, who looks just like King Oliver, playing the trumpet and playing Didn't He Ramble. And then it's also used at the beginning of The Cincinnati Kid with Steve McQueen right at the beginning.
I know that.
So check them out if you can, and watch just the first 3 or 4 minutes, and that's the best part of the movie, frankly. So anyway, there's so much. When the Saints Go Marching In is obviously the biggest permutation of the New Orleans funeral marches and celebrations, I should say. It's obviously not as secular as Didn't He Ramble. When the Saints Go Marching In is the anthem everywhere. And Louis Armstrong is the main reason for that, because he recorded it in 1938, despite people telling him it was too religious. You can't do that. He recorded it anyway, and it became a theme and an anthem everywhere, and even named our football team.
Yeah, also, like I mentioned earlier, I'm a big Trombone Shorty, Orleans Avenue fan, and one of his albums, he starts it out with a dirge, and, it's just so typical New Orleans. It's just, dirges don't work in Pittsburgh.
Well, I mean, they play dirges all over the world, actually. It's the celebratory part that they don't do at funerals. Okay, only in New Orleans did they do that, or in places where they had African roots or Caribbean and stuff, they did celebrate at funerals. But that's extremely rare. That was not done in any European type place, because it got into the American culture because of New Orleans, because they did it in New Orleans, and it spread all over the world. And that's why, like I say, When the Saints Go Marching In is known all over the world, because it popularized in New Orleans mainly because of Louis Armstrong, and it went all over the world, and that's a New Orleans funeral march. Go on.
Okay, so we're going to go to Professor Longhair, and it's funny. We had a slight hiccup on this because I'd listened to part one, and I went back to Rick and said, that's not the one I remember. And then we found it was part two, and I said it was on Clock Records, and let me tell you that Professor Longhair is not Davy Baby Cortez, but it's actually on Watch Records, so I wasn't that far off. So here we go with Big Chief Part 2 by Professor Longhair, covered by so many people. Rhythm that is so New Orleans, it's not even funny. That's New Orleans through and through.
Yeah, and it's a classic. But Professor Longhair, they call him Fess down here, got so much help on that, and thank God he did. The thing is that he, like I said, he only really had one big chart record, and that was Baldhead. But he was a local legend and did go to the Mardi Gras in New Orleans several times. The big version, hit version, was recorded in 58, but then right after that he got busted for pot. And so he was really in a bad situation. He really couldn't make ends meet and didn't record for a while. And what happened is he actually was ending up pushing a broom at the one-stop record shop in the early 60s. And they got it together for a session for Watch Records, and the great arranger is a guy named Wardell Cazare, okay? And you hear about Alan Toufan a lot, but you don't hear very much about Wardell Cazare, and in some ways Wardell Cazare was just as great or as almost as great as Alan Toufan. Because he produced a slew of great records. He produced Earl King. He did Willie T. He did Barefootin' by Robert Parker. He did Chapel of Love by the Dixie Cups. He did Mr. Big Stuff by Marva Wright. He did Gene Knight, and he did Groove Me by King Floyd. And so right at the beginning or in the middle of his productions, he did this, which has his great – he was the expert on horn arrangements. And so you can hear the great horn arrangement in there and the great drumming by Smokey Johnson. But also almost totally forgotten in this is that Professor Long didn't write this. Do you all know who wrote this?
I don't. No.
Was it wasn't Dr.
Earl
John,
King.
Was it? Wasn't Mac Rabinat?
Earl King, who had his first big, he's a disciple of Guitar Slim, who did the great hit, The Things That I Used to Do, Lord, I Won't Do No More. And he had a similar swamp pop hit himself called Those Lonely, Lonely Nights, which is a classic. And then the early 60s with Wardell Cazera, he recorded Trick Bag, which is one of the great, novelty songs. But, I mean, it has such a great funk groove to it. And then, of course, the great Come On, which is subtitled Let the Good Times Roll. Come on, baby, let the good times roll, which was covered by Jimi Hendrix on Electric Ladyland. Okay. So Earl King was a good friend of mine. We used to talk late at night because he would stay at the Tasty Donuts in New Orleans, and I was in Covington, but I would call him sometimes just like 2 a.m. or whatever and have great conversations. He was an amazing, amazing guy. But he wrote this Mardi Gras song for Professor Longhair to sing. But Professor Longhair couldn't learn the lyrics. And, he was probably physically messed up at the time because, like I said, he was in poor shape because of a lot of reasons, besides being a janitor at the One Stop Record Shop. And so that's actually Earl King singing on this record. And I believe it's Earl King whistling too, but I knew from Mardi Gras New Orleans that Professor Longhair could whistle good. So he at some point he did the whistling and he obviously learned the lyrics so he could do it himself. But on the actually original record, that's Earl King singing it. So the great Earl King is another person that doesn't get the credit he deserves. He wrote Willie T's Teasing You and just a bunch of hits. He wrote hits by Do Re Mi by Lee Dorsey. And he wrote hits for the songs for the Dixie Cups and a lot of people. But anyway, that's Earl King on there, and it became a classic recording. And let's get on to the next one, I think, is the Dixie Cups.
Now, before we go, I just want to brag a little bit that actually in my record collection, I have a Mint Minus record of Professor Longhair doing Misery on Ebb Records. So
wow.
I just needed
to... Those are pretty valuable these days, I think.
Yes, they are. I can believe that. So we're going to the Dixie Cups. I must say I'm a little – I was a little disappointed you didn't pick Iko Iko. However, this particular tune is absolutely friggin' awesome. This is Two-Way Puck Away by the Dixie Cups.
Puck Away. I mentioned that this is the forerunner of the famous Hey Pockaway.
Okay.
By the Meters. So, and this dates back to Mardi Gras Indian time. So go ahead.
Okay, here we go.
Dixie,
chair dancing
really
to that, the, I'll tell you.
Yeah, you really get the feel of Mardi Gras Indians. And, I mean, most people do not know what Mardi Gras Indians are. Well, again, unless you're a New Orleans music aficionado, you have no clue. And what it is the thing is that from the very beginning that blacks were in New Orleans, they related to Indians because they were both, oppressed people, And so they would help each other. And what happened is that New Orleans was famous for all of its swamps that it had around the city. And so what would happen is that blacks, sometimes Indians, and there were Indians were originally slaves too, the original slaves up until 1619, well, it's not 1619, it's 1719 is when the first slave ships arrived in New Orleans, a year after the city's founding. And so when Indians obviously could go back to their tribes, but the African slaves would go hide in the swamp. Okay, and they called them Maroons, but they were sometimes aided by the Indians, and that relationship continued on. And what would happen is that I think blacks would start dressing like Indians at Mardi Gras time, okay, because that was one time that they could get away with looking different. They could walk around freely because they were wearing masks or makeup at least. And feathers, okay? And, the lighter-skinned blacks especially could get away with it. And that continued as long as slavery was around. And then it continued after that in that they commemorated that situation by dressing as Indians, after the end of slavery. And it has become only really well known in the last 50 years that situation existed, because that was when they were started recording. This 50 years ago, they actually had a chart hit 50 years ago called "Smoke My Peace Pipe, Smoke It Right," which is black Indians recording a funk song about smoking a peace pipe. Okay, and they dressed as Indians, Ernie Cato, Jelly Roll Morton, Champion Jack Dupree, all were Indians. They dressed as Indians, and they did that, not full time, but they did it at Mardi Gras time, and it was a way for the black people to have more freedom. And so that it's now a huge thing is that they record their songs, and these are some of their songs. And the other version is the other famous one that the Dixie Cups popularized was Ico Ico, which had actually been first recorded by James Sugarboy Crawford in 1953 and became a minor hit then, but it was called Giacomo at that point. And there's a great book by John McCusker and a co-author that Shane Leaf about Mardi Gras Indians. And John McCusker actually dug up a quote from 1879 in which they do a lyric that has obviously became part of Ico Ico. And it says, they talk about Indians. They dress, each has a mask, and they dress like fantastic costume. Here's one of them now singing, Chickamo Mafino, Chickamo Mafino. A shout as an Indian makes his way through the crowd, jingling his belt and flourishing his tomahawk. And if you listen to Ico Ico, it goes, Ico Ico, I go Asande, Chacamo Fino, Anane, Chacamo Finane. So that's Chickamo Fino. It's the exact same thing. That's 1879. So that's
wow.
Astounding.
Yeah, I always
yeah.
wonder where those lyrics
and
came
And so
from
look for
I
their book,
Ico.
Giacomo. But anyway.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
before
I think
we go
we're
on to the next
short.
Song, let me talk to this.
Probably gonna be
okay, we're going to go into... Okay, hold on, guys. We're going to go into, like in 3 minutes, we're going to go into overtime. So people are listening now. What you want to do, hopefully it'll go no problem. We won't be cut off. And you can then just wait until tomorrow or later tonight and just catch the rest of the show. But I just wanted to warn everyone that, and now 2 minutes and 30 seconds, we'll be going into overtime. So there. So we only have 2 more songs to go. So we're in pretty good shape here. Okay, I'm done.
Okay, well, this is the second line by Bill Sinagaw and his Skyliners, which I believe was released in 1964, but it has very, very deep roots. And I mentioned earlier that the Dave Bartholomew playing the trumpet thing, went back to Buddy Bolden. Well, that's at the beginning of this record, too. And then it goes into an old tune. And if you listen carefully, you'd be very familiar with that tune because it's the same tune as Rock Around the Clock.
There you go.
The thing is that Bill Haley took it from this tune. He had a song called Rock Around the Clock. But if you listen to the original version by Sunny Day and the Night, it doesn't sound anything like this. Bill Haley had traveled down to New Orleans, and he heard this tune, which is basically a trombone part. And Al Rose, his famous New Orleans music historian, jazz historian, confirmed this to me, that he probably heard this from the clubs around the lake, which this song had been played. And that there was actually... Charlie Barnett recorded a version of this. It has several different titles, but it's called usually called the Holler Blues, or it's called I'm blanking out. But anyway, it's called under several different titles. I'll think of the other name I was thinking about. But Charlie Barnett actually recorded a version of this in 1942, so it predates Rock Around the Clock by a long shot. And so the greatest selling record of all time for many, many years, Around the Clock, came from a New Orleans jazz standard, in which you're about to hear a more modern version of it, which is played every day in the streets of New Orleans.
And so here we go, and hopefully we will not be cut off, and we weren't, so that's a good thing. This is Second Line, Part 1 by Bill Sinagaw and the Skyliners. Yeah, yeah, rock and roll, out of the clock. Absolutely.
The thing is, it took me years and years, decades, to research that story. And there's a lot of other connections to it, which I go into in the forthcoming book I'm working on. But even Jim Dawson, who wrote a book on Rock Around the Clock, recognized that the tune had been replaced, and there was connections both with both that and with Hank Williams' Move It On Over, he said, which he took from a Mardi Gras tune, and that's what Jim Dawson, who is a Los Angeles rock and roll historian, and like I said, he wrote a whole book on Rock Around the Clock, so he recognized it, and there were several other people that have recognized it, but it's kind of like there's so many indigenous songs in New Orleans that become, go into the larger culture without people realizing it. The title I was trying to think of was Joe Avery's tune. That's Holler Blues and Joe Avery's tune are two of the best known titles for it, but there's actually a half a dozen titles for it. But like I say, Al Rose said it was the trombone part was what the main melody there, and it's been popular since at least the 40s, if not earlier, probably earlier, in New Orleans, and people have never realized it. So anyway, that's the Joe Avery is the significant. Is the person who is associated with thing is he died in 1955 and he had never recorded the song. Okay. And so he didn't have any chance to claim Rock Around the Clock, and his band, which was the Young Tuxedo Band, didn't record it until 1958. And so people think, oh, they're aping Rock Around the Clock. No, Rock Around the Clock aped them. So there's a lot of New Orleans connections similar to that, like, for instance, how many do you anybody know who wrote Sing, Sing, Sing? Great Benny Goodman.
I don't know.
Louis Prima,
Sing,
I think.
Sing, exactly. Sing, 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 which is one of the prime anthems of the swing era, was written by Louis Prima. Think about that. That's pretty heavy. And as a matter of fact, Louis Prima is not known for writing songs. Everything he did was cover version. He wrote Oh Babe, that was a big hit, and he co-wrote A Sunday Kind of Love. But those are the only songs that he's known for. But he never received hardly any credit for writing Sing, 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 which is the most African rocking, jungle kind of record with that great a drum solo by Benny Goodman's drummer, Gene Krupa.
Krupa, yeah.
So he never got any credit for that, even though he wrote it and first recorded it. Okay. And on top of that, the song In the Mood. Anybody heard of In the Mood? Anybody have any clue on the origin of that?
Of course, Glenn Miller.
Oh, I know, but I can't think who wrote it.
Okay. The riff of In the Mood, was on a Winging and Manone record in 1930 called Tar Paper Stomp.
Wow.
So there's so many roots of popular music, and that's the biggest swing hit ever. There's so many roots, and arguably Sing, Sing, Sing is the second biggest.
Carl and I have talked many times about how back in the 40s and the 50s and 60s, early 60s, as a free-for-all, people were copying each other's styles and copying each other's songs and trying to one-up each other. Interesting, Louis Prima, you mentioned that. Big Bad Voodoo Daddy came out with an album called Louis, 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 with Louis Prima, Louis Armstrong, and Louis, who was the other one, Carl?
Oh, I'm trying to think.
Yeah. Well, anyways, that was covered on there. Sing, Sing, Sing is on that album.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, like I said, there's so many things like that I've dug up, and I've got huge book coming out on the roots of New Orleans music. Unfortunately, it's going to be 2 or 3 years down the road, but it's amazing stories. I just hope that everything goes right and it comes out. But we'll cross our fingers on that.
Absolutely. Let's move on to our next one.
Okay.
Finish
it's
up.
Mardi Gras.
PC, sorry.
We just played 2 Mardi Gras records, which was the Dick the Cups, Two Way Pocaway, and Second Line, which is huge, huge at Mardi Gras, but it's played every day in New Orleans. And this is the Rebirth Brass Band. Now, my friend Jerry Brock is the founder of WWOZ Radio, so I don't know if y'all are familiar with that, but that is the New Orleans Roots radio station, which is streamed all over the world. It is plays mostly New Orleans music, but a lot of roots music of all sorts, and New Orleans jazz, et cetera. And Jerry Brock was instrumental in not only founding a station, but also recording some of the first New Birth brass bands. He was one of the first ones to record, if not the first one to record, both the Dirty Dozen Brass Band and the Rebirth Brass Band, who were the leaders of the brass band revival in New Orleans, which has been going like gangbusters for the last 40 years since then. And the Rebirth, and this is their number one idol, although they number one anthem, and but they have several anthems. Kermit Ruffins is one of their alumni. There's so many great brass band records, and this is one of them, and it's played especially at Mardi Gras.
Okay, so this is Do What You Want Up, Part 3, the Rebirth Blues Band.
Rebirth Brass
Band. Yes!
Brass Band.
Yeah. Do what you want, huh?
What year is that from?
The 90s, I believe. I don't know exact year.
Yeah,
but,
I thought so.
The thing is that there are literally hundreds of songs like that. I mean, there's literally and hundreds of bands. And the reason why is because of one of our jazz legends, Danny Barker. Grew up in the 20s playing banjo and actually first played ukulele and in little spasm bands, as they call them, and won some contests. But anyway, he went on to play banjo and guitar with Cab Calloway in New York City in the 30s. And he had a Midland career in New York City for 20-something years, and his wife is a Blue Lou Barker, who had one great hit called Don't You Feel My Leg, which was covered by Maria Muldaur and Dirty Dozen Brass Band, a bunch of people, the Risque song. But anyway, Danny Barker in the mid-60s decided he wasn't doing it, accomplishing anything in New York City, and decided to come back to New Orleans. And he came back, and he specifically had the idea. Jelly Roll Morton was kind of his mentor. And Jelly Roll Morton had tried to teach musicians, but he taught them from a very arrogant, self-centered way, you know, and they didn't take him seriously. But Danny Barker was a great teacher. He could relate to young people, and that's what he did, is he taught the next generation coming out of New Orleans, because New Orleans brass band music was dying. The funeral tradition was dying, and Danny Barker almost single-handedly brought it back by getting all these young kids to play these musicians, these instruments, which they hadn't been touching because they were going into soul and funk and everything else. But he said, that's cool. You can play your funk. Just combine it with these New Orleans jazz traditions, and you can have a great gumbo of music. And that's what he did. And to me, he is so much the father of what has happened in the last 40 years in New Orleans music. That, like I said, there are hundreds of bands like this, and the kids coming up, instead of, like I say, going into rap or going into soul or funk or whatever, they combine it with the brass band tradition, which is such an awesome way of continuing on New Orleans tradition. And the great trombone shorty, you can hear the trombone shorty has the same roots as what you just heard. That's exactly where he came out of. And he's just in his 30s, you know. And same thing with John Batiste. He's very much out of that same thing. And he's producing a lot of great music too. And so it's wonderful. I mean, it's sad that the New Orleans R&B tradition that I wrote so much about in the 80s and 90s is pretty much dying out, but the brass band tradition continues on largely thanks to Danny Barker and I give my friend Jerry Brock a little plug because he helped it too. And so there's so many things. And actually, you know, Wynton Marsalis is part of that. But Wynton Marsalis is kind of like Joe Leroy Morton. He's not – he's up on a Mount Olympus, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah, exactly.
So the thing is that the wonderful thing is that it's a street tradition again, you know, and people are making – kids are making money even if they're just playing, you know, in the French Quarter for dollars in a hat, you know. They're bringing it out and they're doing it and making money and it's keeping the tradition alive. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, you have to feel good with what Troy Andrews is doing, Trombone Shorty. I mean, I think he's really, you know, he's tapping into those New Orleans roots. And,
yep.
You know, he's funk and everything, but, I mean, he's keeping that tradition alive. Of course, you know, they handed the baton over to him as the man for the jazz festival now. You know,
yeah.
Neville
yeah,
Brothers
well, I mean.
Said, okay, you're well, it. You carry it
well,
on.
Well,
for us.
Well, funk is in that. And they even throw in some rap in some of those things. They that's the wonderful thing is that Danny Barker told them, that's all right. You can throw in whatever you want to. Just keep the tradition alive, you know. That was what the wonderful thing about his teaching. And like I say, Danny Barker is responsible so much with reviving New Orleans music in the last 50 years, really, because he came back in 65. And he dedicated the remaining years that he had, which was, I think he died in the early 90s, to doing that. And thank God he did.
Yeah, because like
well,
I
you
said,
know, one of the things, you said that I want to make a point of is the word gumbo. Now, gumbo, of course, is a type of soup or whatever you want to call it, but a gumbo also is mixing all these different influences, and that's what makes New Orleans music so unique. Because, you know, we haven't even gotten into the Cajun influence and things like that. And there's so much out there that we haven't even touched. So if you ever want to come back with a different playlist, Rick, by all means, come back, please.
I'd be happy to.
You know, I just want to mention a couple of people we haven't mentioned because we're getting to the end of the show. And I want to give both you and TC a chance to do a little bit of promotion. You know, I mean, we haven't, you know, we touched very briefly on Alan Toussaint. We haven't even mentioned Chris Kenner, and people like Lee Dorsey, and so many people, you know, Clifton Chenier, and of course the Neville Brothers, and the Meters and all of that. I mean, there's just so much depth to New Orleans music that anyone who's listening to this, please do some dive in and just do a YouTube rabbit hole because you won't believe what you found. Seriously. And I just wanted to make that point to all our listeners that this is such a deep pool of wondrous cultural heritage and just all different types of music that are just thrown together in this gumbo and it's just an amazing thing. And that's what I love about New Orleans music. And so I just wanted to make that point before we start ended up here. So Rick, I'm going to hand it over to you very briefly. Why don't you plug your book and what you're doing one more time for us? Okay.
All right. Well, I'll mention my first book again, Fats Domino, Blue Monday, Fats Domino and Lost Dawn of Rock and Roll. I won a big national award for best music biography 2007. That's still around. It's still available. So you can get that. And I'm very proud of that. Nobody had ever written a book on Fats. And, you know, he was second only to Elvis Presley in the 50s as far as, you know, rock and roll record sales. And then the book I'm writing on is started out very modestly. I was trying to do a history of New Orleans blues back before rock and roll, but, you know, back to the turn of the century with people like Lonnie Johnson and Champion Jack Dupree But then I came across so much information that was just amazing that I had to add to it. And so it went back farther and farther, and I actually went back to the 19th century and was finding amazing stuff. And so eventually I went back to the founding of New Orleans and found amazing stuff there that was so, about music and how it contributed to the founding of New Orleans and the early colonial years up into the Louisiana Purchase and a Battle of New Orleans, which is amazing musical stuff around that. And New Orleans has contributed just incredibly. Even I found amazing minstrelsy roots, brass band, blues, jazz.
Classical, because we've got Louis Gottschalk too. Just want to do a shout out to Louis Gottschalk.
Louis Moreau Gottschalk. He actually had black influences in his music, and he was famous for that. Amazed the people in France and Paris and Europe in the 1840s. And he then moved back to America and amazed the people here. He was literally the first American serious musician who was known all over the world.
Yes.
And he was highly respected as a pianist, but also as a composer. And he was, brought the, Caribbean African rhythms to serious music and popular music as a whole to some degree. But he only lived to age 40, believe it or not. Achieved amazing things just in that short lifespan. And he actually had a huge hand in the invention of ragtime, which people
absolutely
don't know about. Cuba. He lived in Cuba and all the Caribbean islands. And then he went to South America and he composed things that were syncopated, partly because of the Latin influence that contribute to piano pieces of ragtime. And that's a little known aspect of New Orleans music, because they there's roots there too. And, and as I mentioned before, going into swing, New Orleans has roots of two of the biggest swing hits, as well as, obviously Louis Armstrong was his heyday early heyday was in the 20s and 30s. And then he actually made a huge comeback in the 40s and went on to the rest of his life with huge influence, and partly as a revival of New Orleans music. And then, who can forget Jeller or Morton, his amazing influences, and Sidney Bechet, Buddy Bolden, Mahalia Jackson. I mean, would there be soul music without Mahalia Jackson? Is a question there. I mean, she was the obvious influence of Aretha Franklin.
Absolutely, she was.
The influences are just astounding, and I'm putting together kind of, like I say, the historical outline from 1682, which is the discovery of Mississippi, basically by La Salle, and then 1718, which was the founding of New Orleans, on up to the 1947 is kind of my cutoff date, because that was a big turning point year, and that was when rhythm and blues turned into rock and roll with Roy Brown, who is, believe it or not, still not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even though he is the original rocker, named the music, and created the singing style and the heavy beat. So that's 70 years after his starting that he is, he's been around, and they have still not put him in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I'm a homer, but somebody has to be, because like I said, there still would never be a big Fats Domino book if I hadn't worked 20 years on it. And I've been working over 10 years on this book.
We really appreciate everything you've done, and doing this show tonight has just been, you know, just unbelievable, and we really appreciate it. I'm going to take it over to TC to give your little plug. So go ahead, TC.
Yeah, I got.
Then I'm going to.
We got just 2 minutes, but I just want to say I waited 2.5 hours to hear Rick's dog bark, and that made my night. I finally heard the dog bark. You said at the beginning, well, my dog might bark, and I was waiting for it. But anyway,
I hate to tell you, that's a New Orleans song too. Cousin Joe, how come my dog don't bark anymore? Also covered by Dr. John.
Yes,
well,
I know that one.
I want to tell you the music you picked out for tonight was fantastic, and the information you gave us was priceless. This is probably one of the best podcasts I've ever been on. I really enjoyed it, but I want to put a little plug in. I have a YouTube channel, and like I said, I told you earlier, I go to concerts all over the country, and I shoot videos. And my YouTube channel is TCC77. Those are all capital letters, but I got a lot of Trombone Shorty on there. I got the Revivalists on there. I got Mark Broussard on there. So if you want, and I get right up front. So I got some great video of Trombone Shorty in September when he was here in Pittsburgh. So, you know, you get a little time, jump on that. TCC77. That's my YouTube channel. And Rick, it really great to meet you, and I hope we can do this again because there's so much more we need to listen to and talk about.
Okay, and TC, don't forget your show that you do every week for us.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Sunday nights, Deviant Radio or Deviant Legion Network, Rock This Town Radio with TC, Sunday nights, 8 o'clock Eastern time. Check it out. And we're going to run out of time, so I don't want to stay on it too much, but you'll find me on the Deviant Legion Network.
Okay, as far as Deviant Legion is concerned, housekeeping, just to let you know, tomorrow we have Limes and Vicky back, and they're going to continue their series on the legacy of Star Wars. We started with the original film and the ripoffs, but now we're going to go into the sequels up until the prequels. So we're going to do that, and we're going to continue that series on Tuesdays. On Wednesday, let me just get here for a moment. We're very, very happy to have Joe Badon back with us. Joe is a director, a good friend of the podcast, and he'll be talking about his most recent films, his two shorts, but he also released Sister Tempest, which is now out for sale, and we'll be talking about that. Plus, also, he's planning a musical, an honest-to-God stage musical, which kind of frightens me. So we'll be talking about that, but it's always good to have Joe with us. And on Saturday, Rachel is going down the rabbit hole again with both me and TC, and we're going to start our Women's History Month series, and we're going to be talking about women's activism and protest music. So we'll be talking about that and having a great playlist for you on Saturday. Now, as we end up this podcast, Rick picked out all this wonderful music, but I just couldn't leave that go because we actually talked a little bit about this previous, but I just wanted to bring in one of my favorite people, and we talked a little story about him, and that's Huey Piano Smith. So Rick, do you have any final things to say about Huey Piano Smith and the legacy of him in New Orleans?
Well, he was one of the greats. He's still around, by the way. I was lucky enough to interview him once at his home. I just knocked on his door, and he was kind enough to take me in for an hour. yet another of the amazing musicians, the pianists, the many musicians just in the line of, you know, Jelly Roll Morton, Fats Domino, Professor Longhair, Alan Toussaint, Dr. John. And he wrote so many great songs, the Rockin' Pneumonia, C. Cruz, and this song, and I think you'll know it and love it.
Absolutely. And so do you know Huey Piano Smith, TC?
Yes, I do.
Well, we're going to listen as we go out here to his biggest hit, which is Don't You Just Know It. But before we do, I just have to say one more quintessential New Orleans pianist that has not been mentioned that I love. And we talked about Louis Gottschalk and James Booker was an amazing, amazing pianist. And I heard some versions of his, of Louis Marie Gottschalk that he did that just absolutely floored me. So just a shout out to James Booker. Hello, Mr. Dodd.
Yeah,
how are you?
And Booker played with Huey Smith for a while, and of course Bobby Marchand's the main singer, but also Jerry Hall does the female voices on this. And I should point out that the video of this from Dick Clark's show is actually on YouTube now. So run to YouTube after you see this and check out the video of this, because it's extremely rare, hasn't been seen before. It's actually fake, because Huey Smith, they show him singing lead, but when actually it was Bobby Marchand singing lead, and they have Bobby Marchand singing Jerry Hall's part, which is kind of ironic because Bobby Marchand was a cross-dresser. You know, so
I had heard that about Marchand, actually.
Yeah, no, he did that in clubs. He dressed as a lady with a wig, a blonde wig, in clubs. He was big on that. And so definitely check out the video on YouTube of this.
Okay, and here we go. This is Don't You Just Know It by Huey Piano Smith. Sing along to that. All right, folks.
Good show, Carl. Thank you, man.
All right.
Oh, you're welcome. And Rick, I'm not kidding. Come up with another playlist of New Orleans music, and please come back. Seriously.
All right. All right. Maybe every
right.
6 months. All right, man.
Yeah,
enjoy
make it. 3 months. Make it 3 months.
Yeah.
All right. Listen,
Rick,
thank you very
right.
much. Thanks for listening. And let's say good night.
All right. Good
happy
night.
Mardi
good night.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks a lot, TC.